Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
Writing deadlines are driven by publishing dates, and publishing dates are determined by coinciding events. My guest is Jesse Dougherty, a beat writer for the Washington Post, and his new book, Buzzsaw, The Improbable Story of How the Washington Nationals Won the World Series, is now available. The book's release was meant to fall with the opening day of the 2020 Major League Baseball season. We now know that opening day will come and go with no baseball. Jesse, before we get into your terrific book, what is an MLB beat writer to do now that MLB is shut down?
Promote their book.
Perfect answer.
No, it's weird. I mean, we're trying to find stories to tell that sort of get at the absence of baseball and sort of what this means for not just the Nationals, but also their fans and the country. And I think there is sort of a hole in America right now that sports usually provides. And it's obviously not the most pressing or important story of the day, but it's a story nonetheless. So we're going to keep trying new and creative ways to think about that, but it's definitely odd. You know, your internal clock is set to late March. You start baseball, and this year we're obviously going to have to start a little bit later.
Well, you know, jumping onto the book's subtitle, what made last year's World Series championship so improbable for the Nationals?
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole list of things, right? I mean, I think it can start with that their best player left in free agency the winter before. So you lose Bryce Harper, and you don't really think that team that loses its star is going to now be a competitor for the World Series. So from then on, they sort of were this underdog in a weird way, and then they dropped to 19-31 on May 24th, and it was, you know, their World Series odds were down to 1.5%. Everyone figured the manager would get fired. There was rumblings that some of the veterans could get traded off to plan for the future, and the Nationals stuck with it. They gave themselves at least another week, at least another 2 weeks, and they went on this improbable run where they went on the best 80-game stretch in club history, and it never really stopped. So the improbability was all over. They won 5 elimination games. They trailed in each one. They had never won an elimination game in club history before. They were 4 outs away from losing in the wild card game with Josh Hader on the mound, one of the best relievers in baseball. They were, you know, they were down 2 runs and Clayton Kershaw in the game, you know, with the Dodgers, and they were, you know, 7 outs from losing that game. So, you know, it's just, you know, one thing after another, this team just kept sort of reviving in the last second. So it was pretty amazing to see.
And last year was your first year covering the Nationals, right?
It was my first full season, yeah. I started the last August, but my first full season as a beat writer, yeah.
Well, you know, about 5 years ago, your colleague at the Post, Barry Sferluga, wrote a book in which he described covering the MLB season as a grind for journalists, players, spouses, everyone involved. And the 2019 season was the longest season in Nationals history. Does the word grind even begin to cover your personal experience?
Yeah, I mean, February 11th to October 30th. And I guess if you want to go a little bit further, it would be November 4th was the White House visit, and that's kind of what I saw was the end when they sort of ended their celebration tour. So, yeah, I mean, it was funny. We joked, I mean, that they played as many possible outs as the season would allow, 7 games of the World Series on the last final day of the calendar. So there was no room left for baseball by the time the season was finished, and it was certainly a grind. That was required reading. I read the grind right before the season just to kind of get an idea of what I was in for, and it certainly even surpassed the expectations.
Did you cover every pitch of the season? Were you there for every game?
I covered all but 6 road games, and so 75 road games, and then about probably took off 10 home games. So, you know, about 145 regular season games, and then every game of the postseason, and then all 6 weeks of spring training. So, yeah, pretty much if that team was playing baseball, you could bet that I would be there.
Well, at what point in the season did you know you had a book in you about it?
Yeah, I mean, not until the end. I think if that team, if they lose, they're interesting, but they're not a book. And I think they had to get totally over the hump. But the when I knew this team was good enough to win, when I really thought they could turn the corner, was late August when they swept the Cubs in Chicago. They had come off a really wacky schedule turnaround where they finished the game at 10 p.m. in Pittsburgh and had to turn around and play at 1 p.m. in Chicago. So they pretty much landed at 5 a.m., you know, scrambled to their hotels. Guys were taking naps in their lockers pregame in Chicago that morning. You know, us as beat writers, we had to scramble there too. And they just came out and just totally handled the Cubs at Wrigley. And the Cubs were playing great at home. And they, across 3 days, just beat them in every kind of way possible. And that to me, was the turning point. They were playing really good baseball for about 2 months at that point. But I really felt then that, wow, this team is good. Like, they're good. And the bullpen was sort of coming together. So a book didn't really come until Game 7. I mean, I heard from the publisher 2 days after the World Series ended, on the Friday after. But I think the moment where I really believed the Nationals were a different kind of team was that late August series in Chicago.
And only a print journalist for a daily newspaper would be able to turn around a book so fast from November until here. I mean, you probably had the thing written for, I got my advanced copy a month or two ago.
Yeah. My first full draft was due January 4th. So I started November 11th. So that's about 7 weeks. And I got a little bit of an extension for the end. So I probably had a full version by January 11th. And then we edited for about a week and a half, and that thing was pretty much, you know, getting shipped out to guys like you, you know, February 1st. I mean, February, you know, mid-February. So it was a deadline. I mean, I'm used to writing 700 words in 5 minutes, but this was a little different, where it was 100,000 words in 7 weeks. So you kind of just flipped the expectation a bit, but it felt the pressure was there all the same.
Well, so many iconic moments from last year's season, and I'm sure photos. Juan Soto made the cover of your book. How did that photo get selected to capture the essence?
Yeah, we thought that, so a lot of season books that you'll see like this often have the celebration on the cover, the team on the mound at the end. It's a very sort of, it's a cliche shot, and it's always great. And I think fans of those teams remember those moments forever. In this case, it would have been Daniel Hudson, Jan Gomes, and their teammates running toward them. And we actually have that on the back cover. And we just felt we wanted to use an image that maybe captured some of all the emotions, not just that euphoria at the end. And that Juan Soto photo where he's on his knees and his arms are up in the air and his eyes are closed, there's a measure of relief in there as well. So there's elation, there's happiness, but there's also relief. And, for this team and this city that had gone through so much playoff heartbreak over the years, you know, losing baseball for decades, and then, you know, 2012 and 2014 and 2016 and 2017, great Nationals teams all losing the NLDS, and you start to sort of think, like, is that going to happen every year? And as a fan, it's easy to think, you know, we can't win. So that feeling of relief of sort of getting over the hump and that exhale of, finally, you know, this happened, we finally, finally can win, we thought that Juan Soto image really captured that essence, and I was really happy to sort of go a different route than just the celebration photo that is typically used.
And one of the things I love about the title is nobody would have considered the Nationals a buzzsaw for any significant period of the season last year, except toward the end. So that came from Steven Strasburg's quote, right?
Yes, it was the night they advanced to the World Series, so we're in the Nationals clubhouse, and beers flying all over the place. And, I think I write in the book that it's literally dripping off his beard. I drank so much Budweiser at that point. He said, you know, you can have great years, but you run into a buzzsaw, and maybe this year we're the buzzsaw. And that was him answering the question of why this year. I mean, you've had so many good teams, as I mentioned before. You know, those four playoff runs before this were stacked with talent. But why is this year different? And sometimes, and in a way, that quote sort of just symbolizes, sometimes it's just your turn. Sometimes you catch fire at the right time, and you start being the buzzsaw that no one wants to get in the way of. And at that point, I think they had won 18 of 20 games, going back to the last week of the season. In that stretch, they had eliminated the Phillies from playoff contention, the Indians from playoff contention, the Brewers in the wild card game, the Dodgers in the NLDS, and then the Cardinals in a sweep in the NLCS. So if you think about that in context, I mean, there's probably no better depiction of a literal buzzsaw, just chopping teams out of the picture, and then, you know, as they soon find out, they're going to play the Houston Astros and have one more test.
I'm chatting with Jesse Dougherty about his new book, Buzzsaw, the improbable story of how the Washington Nationals won the World Series. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold. And since there's no baseball on to watch, we can all read about it, and this is good. Jesse, you mentioned the wild card game against the Milwaukee Brewers. I listened to that game on the radio. I listened to Uecker's call. Fire alarm went off in the press box during that game, and Uecker had a little fun with it on the air. Were you in there when that went off?
Yeah, I totally forgot about that. I mean, that night was so insane. But yeah, the fire alarm did go off, and the best part about that was nobody moved.
That's what I was wondering.
We working press is like, you know, the building's burning down. Everyone's like, yeah, I got a story to write. the building was not burning down. I think it was just a mishap in the stadium. But it was just funny that, like, literally not, there was like few people even looked up. Like, there wasn't even an inclination to be like, why is the alarm going off? It was just, like, nope, straight ahead, working.
There's some inside baseball in this thing, and in this book too. And you write about the scouting department, the advanced scouting department inside the Nationals organization. How fundamental is their work?
Yeah, it's big. And I think one of the big things I wanted to do with this book is sort of dispel some sort of prevailing theories out there about the Nationals. I think they're often painted as this sort of archaic, old school, team that doesn't do a lot of numbers and is really into the eye test and the scouts and the boots on the ground. And in a lot of ways, they are, and that fits their sort of ethos. But at the same time, I think they sort of let that narrative spiral forward because they like it. It sort of makes them seem like the sort of bastions of some past era of baseball. And but the truth is, they actually have an extensive analytics department, and their advanced scouting team that I write about in the chapter on the NLCS is a really conscious blend of analytics and sabermetrics, and also that eye test and actually watching in the stands. So I think there was a lot of chatter during the World Series about them, that they're the only team left that really values the scout, and no Ivy League diplomas and all these things. But a lot of those sentiments were just flat out untrue. So I tried to sort of show the balance. I thought one of the best things Mike Rizzo told me during this book process was that the reason why the Nationals are cutting edge is because they haven't sold out fully in one direction. They're not fully scouting. They're not fully numbers. We're cutting edge because we're somewhat down the middle. And in baseball, that is somewhat different. I think a lot of teams are going wholesale in any direction, but the Nationals have sort of kept down the middle in a way that has allowed them to thrive. So I appreciate you asking about that, because the scouting is fundamental, but I also don't think it's the only element that this team uses in preparation. It's just one part of the puzzle.
The Astros cheating scandal dominated the offseason baseball coverage this past winter. What awareness did the Nationals have of what the Astros were up to during the series?
I mean, I don't think to the level that we later found out, like what, co-breaker spreadsheets and actually, knowing every pitch and whatnot, and potentially using devices and all those things. But, I mean, there certainly was a heightened level of paranoia. The Nationals had heard from some past teammates and players they had played with about the Astros. It was definitely something that was on their minds. They had set up a really unique and elaborate sign system to sort of, it was like a repellent for sign stealing. And then there was a conscious effort, and there was a big moment in Game 6, which actually was not necessarily a sign-stealing moment, but it was more Steven Strasburg tipping his own pitches that ended up being a critical moment of the series and a really big turning point. So it was sort of all over that series, the idea of sign-stealing, tipping pitches, the paranoia, the back and forth there, and obviously the Nationals prevailed, but they certainly had measures in place to combat whatever the Astros could have been doing.
And then I think for most baseball fans around the country that followed the Nationals, even on tangential level, we didn't catch on to the baby shark thing until it was a full-blown hit in Washington. Where did that phenomenon arise?
Yeah, it was June. It was actually, it was June 19th, actually, and it was a doubleheader. And that day, everyone will remember that day as the day that Max Scherzer pitched with a broken nose.
Yep.
And that happened in the nighttime game. That was sort of the headline, obviously. And whenever a pitcher does something like that, it was like, Max Scherzer's out there bloodied and black-eyed, and he ends up throwing six scoreless innings against the Phillies. But the actual element of that day that reverberated beyond it was that during the first leg of the doubleheader in the afternoon, Gerardo Parra changed his walk-up song to Baby Shark. And he had been in the slump. I think he was 1-for-23 or 1-for-24. It was his daughter's favorite song at the time. And he decided to change his song and see if he got a shift of luck. And he hit a home run that day. He threw out Bryce Harper with a barehanded play from center field at third base, which I thought was one of the better defensive plays of the season. And from there, he started using it. It became this sort of cult classic at the ballpark where everyone stood up every time and did the shark clap. And Parra teammates started wearing shirts and headbands. And it kind of became this pseudo mascot for the Nationals and part of their sort of screw it, playing with house money mindset. They were kind of this team that you couldn't really rattle because they had already been to the depths of, fourth place in the division, close to the bottom. And now they were going to, just give everything they had and not really worry about the stakes. So that baby shark embodied a lot of that, and it was just funny that on a day when we all were so glued to Scherzer's theatrics, actually the baby shark thing ended up being the more significant development.
Well, it was such a fun season to watch, and then just reliving it through reading your book, I absolutely enjoyed over the last, since I've had the book here. The book is Buzzsaw, The Improbable Story of How the Washington Nationals Won the World Series by Jesse Docherty. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Jesse, I hope you sell a bunch of books, but I also hope that you get back to being able to write about baseball covering actual games fairly soon.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And to get on the soapbox real quick, if you'll give me 30 seconds, I think it's just a huge time right now to support our local independent businesses. So if you can order through your bookstore at home, it's businesses are obviously struggling right now with this world shutdown we're going through. So it's a great time to order books and support them, and hopefully they'll come out on the other side as well. So I think everything will get back to normal soon, and we'll all be in good shape.
Well said, Jesse. Thanks for joining us today.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Yeah. Baby Shark.